Hello. He's worked with Philip Glass, Lou Reed, Allen Ginsberg and Lady Gaga. But why has Robert Wilson gone it alone on Crap's last tape? Also tonight, challenging the bloodthirsty image of the Maya civilization in a landmark new exhibition. And a new novel, Into the Fire, explores the bold theory that Joan of Arc was a trained warrior princess, not a peasant girl hearing voices.
The thing we have to know about Joan of Arc is that we have more about her than about almost any individual of her period. She was the celebrity of her time, and a lot was written at the time. And once you start to examine exactly what she did, I think the evidence is overwhelming that she was a trained knight. But there are a lot of historians that would disagree with that. So it is my theory. It's not an accepted historical fact.
More from Manda Scott later. The secret world of undercover police operations is the focus of Black Work, ITV's new three-part drama, an intriguing mix of crime and conspiracy thriller. Sheridan Smith stars as PC Joe Gillespie, married to a fellow officer. But when he's killed in suspicious circumstances, she discovers he had been working on a covert operation.
No, there's only a handful of people that know that Ryan's dead. And we'd like to keep it that way, for now.
I don't understand.
Ryan was working on an operation for the last 3 years.
No, that can't be right. He was in London 3 days a week training CID officers.
That's not what he was doing, Joe. He was working undercover. He was asked to keep it very tight. No one knew.
Douglas Henschel and Sheridan Smith in Black Work. Crime novelist Denise Mina has watched all three parts and joins me on the line from Glasgow. Now, I have to say, I'm very wary of another police thriller, but I really felt this was like a whirlpool. It sucked me in, and very early on, she finds she's the target of surveillance and cover-up. What did you make of it?
It's a really interesting take on, I mean, it's quite familiar ground if you're watching this and you watch a lot of police procedurals. It does feel very familiar in the sense that you're in a certain world. It's all police officers who are kind of looking at each other very seriously and over it. No one has a sense of humour. And it's quite bloody. And it does an interesting thing that True Detective did, which is it washes over you. There are too many clues to keep hold of, and it makes it incredibly, incredibly compelling. I was contractually obliged to watch two, and I couldn't stop myself watching the third one because you just have to know what's going to happen in it.
I was struck by the acting and the reality of the characters. She has this relationship with her children, especially her teenage stepson. I felt there was a lot of depth to these characters underneath the conspiracy, which is why I enjoyed it.
Well, actually, I was thinking it's kind of a metaphor for divorce. There's a lot of, there are real families in this. There's a stepson and a daughter and then another stepchild and, you know, families kind of overlap. And one of the really interesting things about it is every character or every main character shifts identity at some point in the story. So if you think about it as a divorce scenario instead of your husband's been killed, you know, she's finding out about him after the fact when the pall of love is kind of taken away. So I think that's one of the things that makes it so compelling, is she suddenly realises, did she know this man at all?
A lot of TV crime thrillers seem to be attempting visually this very dark palette of Scandinavian dramas. What did you make of the way it looks? And it's set in Leeds. It's sort of, suppose it's got a very real setting.
Well, you know, I really love Leeds and I think Leeds is really beautiful, but I felt that that spoiled it somewhat. And I had reservations about some of the set design. I've never really thought I would say that phrase, but, you know, at one point they seemed to be questioning people in a chill-out room in a nightclub with halogen lights everywhere. And it didn't make Leeds look great. It looked quite dowdy and drained of colour, and actually it's such a beautiful part of the country, and you never see any red brick, for example, or, you know, any of the really sort of startling things that you see there. So I didn't feel that it looked brilliant, but it's such a compelling story. It really drags you through despite yourself.
And of course it's Sheridan Smith in the central role. There's a lot of great support, Geraldine James and Philip Davis and Douglas Henschel, but she's, you know, the one who's got to carry it. What did you think of her performance?
She's an extraordinary actress. I find her unbelievably compelling on screen.
I
can't honestly watch other actresses when she's on. And Geraldine James is on. Douglas Henschel. You know, all these absolutely amazing actors. Matthew McNulty, who's an extraordinary actor. But she, for some reason, she has such an untelevisual face. She doesn't look like out-of-the-box television actress. You can't stop watching her. And there's always something going on. She's not steam-sealing, but she's just very charismatic. I found her character a bit difficult at the beginning because she's everybody's in love with her. That seems to be, which always makes me a wee bit wary.
And her look is a bit odd, isn't it?
She looks a bit like Ruth Madoc in Heidi High, which, I mean, it might be that the writer is younger than me and didn't. That's not one of their kind of cultural touchstones. Not that it's one of mine, but it's quite hard to get away from.
No, and it's a small distraction though, because it is overall, there's a lot to enjoy. And you've managed not to give away the plot twist, Denise, which we're very grateful. Thank you so much. And Black Work starts on ITV this Sunday at 9 p.m. The dramatic thunderstorm that opens a new production of Crap's Last Tape at the Barbican in London. The effect is not in the stage directions of Samuel Beckett's strange short play. The script is, in fact, mostly stage directions, in which we watch a man pacing around a room, play audio diary tapes from his past, and ponder the passing of his life. Actor and director Robert Wilson is best known for his collaboration with Philip Glass on Einstein on the Beach. Wilson met Beckett many years ago, and in this production has decided to remain as close to the playwright's vision as possible, notably playing the part with a painted white face, looking like Buster Keaton in a silent film.
I had a play in Paris in 1972, and he came to see it, and he came backstage, and we talked. So a few nights later, we met, and we had dinner. I was very intimidated. Beckett was a giant for me, and a god of the theater, and on that. I said, what actors do you like? He said, oh, my favorite is Buster Keaton. I said, that's my favorite too. And we talked about the silent movie actors and how everything was artificial, that it all dealt with timing. And Charlie Chaplin, it's everything is like dance. It's timing. There's nothing naturalistic about it. There's nothing psychological about it. It's all artificial. The makeup is artificial. The movements are artificial. It always seems strange to me to see Beckett done in a heavy, naturalistic, psychological way. Well, I hate naturalism. I think it's to be on stage is something artificial, and it always seems so stupid to me, actors who are trying to act natural. If you accept it as something artificial, then you can be perhaps more honest about what you're doing. The way you speak on stage is not the way you speak in a restaurant, and the way you walk on stage is not the same as walking down a street. And the way you sit, for me, is not the way you sit waiting for a bus on the street, because the stage space is different.
Can I ask about the sound? Because what's interesting, given that the silent movie look of it is really striking, is, of course, it's called Crap's Last Tape, and it's this interaction between the character and these audio tapes of himself. It's quite interesting how oral it is, especially in an age when we think of the confessional of Facebook or something, which is very visual, or writing in a diary. And this is something quite different because it is hearing the voice on the tape.
What's touching for me about the work is the way the man touches a tape recorder. And, you know, it can be violent, can be very tender. He's in love with this machine and hearing a tape of his voice.
39 today, sound as a bell. Apart from my old weakness and intellectually, I have now ever reason to suspect at the crest of the wave or thereabouts, celebrated the awful occasion as in recent years quietly at the wine house. Not a soul.
I've met other actors who keep coming back to Beckett. In a way, I wonder what brings you back, because when you see it as an audience member, it enthralls you, but it is bleak. What is the enduring appeal as a performer and a director that brings you back to a play like Crap's Last Tape?
Well, I'm interested in, first of all, the way he structured the work, that he dared to repeat texts over and over. The difficulty of doing Beckett, and I've seen this play done a number of times, is one, to play the silence, and two, the humor. And we shouldn't make theater if we can't laugh. And I think that's why Beckett loved the silent movie actors. You see Charlie Chaplin, a little tramp who's starving, and he's eating his shoes, and you laugh, you know, at this tragedy. To me, that's essential if you're doing Waiting for Godot or whatever you're doing of Beckett. How do you find the humor?
Sat before the fire with closed eyes, separating the grain from the husk. Jotted down a few notes on the back of an envelope. Good to be back in my den, in my old rags. Have just eaten, I regret to say, 3 bananas, and only with difficulty refrain from a fourth. Fatal things for a man with my condition. Cut 'em out!
I've got it in front of me. It's barely 6 sides of A4 as text. Mm. And yet, there's all these specific instructions about the actions, and then there's all the possibility of interpretation. Mm-hmm. It's very demanding on an actor physically to carry that on their own, and yet
I mean, in my production is 53 minutes before I speak the text. So how do you hold an audience for 53 minutes? Usually you open your mouth and start speaking. I do everything that Beckett prescribed in his text. In fact, the Beckett estate came when I first did it in Italy. So we're surprised you did everything that is Beckett asked one to do. All kinds of details in terms of gestures or actions or whatever. But you learn it just like you learn anything. How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. Examples gross as her. That's Hamlet. I learned it when I was 12, and I'm 73, and I'm still saying it. I once asked a beautiful Balanchine dancer, Suzanne Farrell, I said, how many ballets do you know? She said, 75, maybe 85. And I said, in Symphony in C, it's so extraordinary when you do such and such. And how do you do this? Oh, she said, I have no idea. I only know how I do it when I'm doing it. Go back to Charlie Chaplin. I met Chaplin when I had my first play in Paris. He came backstage afterwards, and a 17-year-old girl said, oh, Mr. Chaplin, the act you do in Limelight, the flea act, is so marvelous. How do you do that? He said, my dear, I've been doing that for 45 years. They grew up in vaudeville, doing acts over and over and over. So I was quite strict with myself in trying to do exactly what he asked an actor to do in this. You know, you learn the steps, and that's boring. And the form is boring, actually. It's how you feel within the form and how you fill out the form. You learn that, and after a while, you have a kind of freedom. Not until we're totally mechanical are we free.
The new light above my table is a great improvement. With all this darkness around me, I feel less alone. In a way, I love to get up and move about in it. And then back here to me, Crap.
Robert Wilson, and he'll be performing Crap's last tape at the Barbican from tomorrow until Sunday. You're listening to Front Row with me, Samira Ahmed, and you can catch up with all the reviews and interviews we do on the programme by signing up for our podcast. Search for Front Row online or in the Radio iPlayer app. Our fascination with the lost Maya civilization in what is now Mexico continues to grow, not least because of the speed of its annihilation by the Spanish conquistadors. As long ago as the 17th century, Henry Purcell wrote an opera, The Indian Queen, about the conquistador encounter with this ancient and violent culture. And much of our fascination is with its practice of human sacrifice and astronomical superstition. Remember that prediction about the end of the world a few years ago. Now a new exhibition at World Museum Liverpool, Maya's Revelations from an Ancient Time, attempts to challenge some of the prejudices about Maya culture. Featuring nearly 400 objects from key city sites, including jade funeral masks, it's been developed by the Mexican Museum of Anthropology. Dr. Amy Fuller, a lecturer in the history of the Americas at Nottingham Trent University, has been to see it and joins me now on the line from Leicester. There is a horrible histories kind of schoolchild fascination in this country, isn't there, with the Mayas and human sacrifice. What did you make of the way this exhibition presented you with their civilization and the story it was trying to tell?
Well, I was really struck as soon as I walked in at the calm of the exhibition. It's a great kind of challenging of these perceptions. You go in and you're immediately struck by a timeline to your right that shows you just how long the civilization went on for a start, but also comparing it to other parts of the world and what was going on there. And you especially see that as the Maya civilization was starting to form, what was happening in England was, you know, not very much at all, really.
In terms of objects as well,
yes.
Because even just looking, you know, in the way that the image, the exhibition is presented online, they've got these beautiful jade and gold objects, haven't they?
Yes, it's beautiful. Even if you already know a lot about the Maya, just from the sense of seeing the artwork and the craftsmanship, it's a wonderful exhibition. And as you say, it does challenge those perceptions. And
What sorts of things do you see then? These jade funeral masks, for example, what do they reveal? I'd never heard of these before.
Well, that was one of my favourite things, really, with the funeral masks. And what would happen was they were meant to replace, they were used for great rulers, great kings, to replace the face that would obviously decay so that there would be a sense of immortality, that they would live forever. And so when you go into the exhibition and you see these faces looking back at you from the case, it's quite striking to think, well, they have lived forever. They're looking out at us now in the 21st century, and their legacy lives on.
This focus on time as well,
yes.
Then. How is that part of the narrative, and what objects reveal anything about the Maya concept of time?
Well, there's a great piece on the calendar, and as you said about the this Maya apocalypse myth is not, it's ignored completely, which it should be, because it's nonsense. And instead, there's a great interactive piece that where you can try to understand how the calendar works, and it shows how the different cycles interlock, and you can actually find today's date or your birthday and look at what that is in Maya. And there's a real sense of how important actually the counting system and the writing system is as well, because that's one of the ways in which we've grown to understand the Maya is once we started to decipher their writing. Beforehand, we didn't really know very much about them, but thankfully they have written all over the monuments and various other artefacts, and they're very fastidious about dating everything, so we can date everything with great accuracy.
This has been put together by the Mexican government,
yes.
Obviously with an attempt to kind of correct the image, and
yes.
You of course know many of the sites these exhibits come from. Briefly, how far do you think it does convey a modern sense of geography and of how we should see the Mayas then?
Well, the way in which some of the objects have been placed give you a really good sense of the context. So, for example, there is a ball game ring or hoop, if you like, that's suspended in the air. Not quite as high as it is at the site in Chichen Itza, but it gives you a sense of that is where it should be, up in the sky. A lot of the objects have been mixed together in terms of the geography and the time scale.
We'll have to leave it there, sadly, Amy, but you've given us such a lovely flavour of it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Maya's Revelation of an Endless Time is on at World Museum Liverpool from tomorrow until October the 18th. Now, many of us first encountered as children the remarkable short life of Joan of Arc, the 14th century armour-clad French woman fighting English occupation. Reading as an adult about her prowess in battle and her political skill makes her even more fascinating, especially as much of it was carefully documented from battlefield to her trial and execution. Manda Scott's new novel, Into the Fire, explores with a real sense of period and adventure the theory that Joan of Arc could not have been an illiterate peasant girl, but the illegitimate daughter of Charles VI, raised as a warrior with a mission to save France under a secret identity. And she parallels that story with one of a modern mayoral election in the city of Orléans, where all sides, including the far right, are battling for ownership of St. Joan and what she represents about French identity. Manda Scott had previously written an acclaimed series of novels about Britain's warrior Queen Boudicca, so was Joan of Arc the obvious next choice?
Yes, obviously. When I'd done Boudicca, Joan of Arc is the next in the line of great women warriors. But all I'd been told about her was that she was a standard bearer, that she went into battle and did nothing at all. And I wasn't interested in writing about a cipher. Once I discovered that that wasn't what she'd been, then she became endlessly fascinating.
This theory that she was a trained knight, which you explore, what's the evidence for that and how did you come across the idea?
I read an article in The Independent back in 2003. A Ukrainian orthopaedic surgeon who specialised in building faces on skulls had been invited to France. He ended up looking at the contents of the tomb of the son of the man that Joan put on the throne. There were seven bodies in the tomb. So there was the king, his wife, and then five others, of whom four were knights who were identifiable. And he said that the last one was a woman who had died in her late 50s or early 60s, and looking at her bone structure, he said this woman had trained to ride a warhorse in full armour from a really early age. And he said this was Joan of Arc, and they closed the tomb and they threw him out of France. So straight away I had my contemporary thriller. There are people in France who will do a lot to keep this quiet, and it isn't much of a fictional leap to killing to keep it quiet. And I had, this woman was a warrior. This woman trained from a really early age, which she must have been to be a knight. And then I could write about that. The thing we have to know about Joan of Arc is that we have more about her than about almost any individual of her period. She was the celebrity of her time, and a lot was written at the time. And once you start to examine exactly what she did, I think the evidence is overwhelming that she was a trained knight. But there are a lot of historians that would disagree with that. So it is my theory. It's not an accepted historical fact.
Well, we've got a section in the novel describing her in battle. And I have to say, these parts of the book are the most amazingly evocative of this
Thank
woman
you.
who fights with such strength and taunts the English.
Yeah.
Would you like to read us there?
I absolutely will. Thomas is a horse's length behind the maid when she singles out her target. A flashy rider on a flashy bay, sporting a blue velvet cloak and swan feathers in his hat. This is Franquet Dara, the bandit captain whom the king has ostensibly come here to hunt. But the king is not hunting him, and the maid has seen him, and he is caught between the stream and the hedge with nowhere to run. In the last three strides, he brings his shield to the fore. She aims her lance for the centre. The maid's lance is built for war. It does not shatter. Rather, her enemy soars back over the near side quarters of his horse.
You parallel the story of Joan in her lifetime with this modern kind of conspiracy. It's an election for a new mayor in Orléans, and they're battling over who she is. Why do you think, which your book very much hints at, that the French need to keep her as a peasant and wouldn't like the idea that she might be an illegitimate daughter of, you know, a great king?
Because France would have become divided. The king that she put on the throne was acknowledged to be a bastard. He was illegitimate. His mother said so. His real father was the actual king's brother. Here we have the acknowledged daughter of the king who can fight. Charles VII was not a fighter. So you've got a woman who has won in war. The man who married her could have made himself king. And then not only would the English have been contending the French throne, but two sets of French nobles would have been contending the French throne. And I think that right from the beginning, when Yolanda of Aragon brought her to Chinon, the deal was, you are not going to say who you are ever. And she went to great lengths during her trial to obfuscate any possibility of anybody looking closer into who she might have been.
And you really believe this theory?
I absolutely do. It's the only thing that fits, and it fits in so many different ways that I think it's not possible that she was anything else. It took 20 years to train boys how to fight. She did not learn in 11 days. She knew how to ride. She was Olympic-level dressage horsewoman. She had been trained for a long time. she referred to the Duke d'Orléans, the second most powerful man in the land. She told him she would have his head struck from his shoulders if he didn't do what she told him to do. I truly don't believe a peasant, however God-struck, would ever say that. And she wasn't God-struck. She didn't mention saints or angels at all until she was under questioning, many, many days of questioning by the English. And right at the end, when she was captured because she was functioning as a true knight. She would not go back into Compiègne until her men were in safety. She knew all of this. She had been trained by somebody who not only knew the rules of the tournament, but really cared about them. And Charles VI was that man.
You know what's fascinating reading this book is that she is like the superhero that we see her as, isn't she?
Yes.
The way she performs
yes.
in battle. But you never attempt to get inside her head. This character, Thomas, who's initially loyal to the English and he's their agent and then completely falls for her power and her authority, is the way that we see her. And I thought that was very interesting. You didn't attempt to get inside her mind or indeed the minds of other women at that time. You look at her from outside and try and fathom who she is.
I have 80,000 words written from inside her head. And that was my original look at it. It didn't work in the context of a dual timeline novel because this is a thriller and it has to have the narrative cadences of a thriller. It needed both sides to be asking a question, and the question had to be, who was this person? And you can't have that question if you're looking at it from her inside.
Your decision to have a parallel plot when you could have written the novel just about her and you could have written a separate novel just about a modern police detective and an investigation into the mystery of the tomb. You put the two together for a reason and you tie it up with the idea of Marine Le Pen and the whole battle to own Joan of Arc in modern French
yes.
politics. Why did you do that?
Because I think it's fascinating. I didn't want to write two separate books. I don't think there's really room for that. I didn't want to have to choose between the two. Do I write a historical? Do I write a modern thriller? And I thought that there would be a way of weaving the two together in a way that would hold people between each thread. And because the modern day, that concept, the right in France has hijacked her. They've taken this woman, they've made her the icon of perfect womanhood, the virginal, godly, peace-loving Republican. She wasn't any of those things. By the time I'd done the research, it mattered really to my own integrity that we understand who she really was, not the woman who has been hijacked. And you could only really see the importance of that in the current day if you have the contemporary narrative to go with it.
What's your view about how this book might be received there?
I have to say, the challenge of selling it to publish in France has been considerable. They're not happy about the idea that their patron saint might not be all that she was portrayed to be. I am hashtag radical truth. That's what I think we've got. And people don't always like it.
Joan of Arc is that story we all read as kids in the Lady Bird book where we felt ashamed to be English.
Yes.
And we knew that she was the right side and we were the wrong side. And as a Scot as well, reading this after the referendum and seeing all this historical tensions about the relationship between Scotland and England and its relationship with France, it's got new resonances, doesn't it?
It really does, yes. And when I went to Orléans, there is this plaque on the wall that is the names of the Scots who fought for Orléans and it's still there. And so trying to find the balance between Scottishness, Englishness and Frenchness when actually I think those boundaries should be falling and we should be looking at ourselves as Europeans and citizens of the world was another very interesting circle to look at.
Manda Scott on the 15th century warrior, Joan of Arc, and Into the Fire is published today. Tomorrow, Julie Taymor on A Midsummer Night's Dream. Join Kirsty at 7:15.